right, and this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:59 a.m. and coming up at 10. We're Cascadia with your host, Chris Andre, bringing you headlines, interviews, and commentary, followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints. That's a rebroadcast of yesterday evening's program from KPFA in Berkeley, and we thank Pacifica Radio for providing that. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, host Dan Johnson speaks with Max Miscotti, director of Stage Metro Portland, working to enhance the lives of older LGBT community members and the upcoming SAGE Expo. And thanks, KBU members, for your financial support. If you made a pledge during the recent membership drive, be sure to fulfill that ASAP. And here's Air Cascadia on KBOO Portland.
Cascadia. Today is Thursday, September 30th, 2016, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM on the air, kboo.fm on the web. Today's guest is Chuck Sams, the chief of the Umatilla Nation, and he is joining us to talk about, land management is a large part of the story, and yes, money is a large part of the story, but the relationship between a people and land that has laughably changed hands, because it actually can't in the First Nations point of view and tradition. It's impossible to for any creature to own land, because it's like saying you own your foot or something of that nature. It's simply, if you think about it, it's not possible. So transfers of land from one person to another that involve money are really a shared hallucination. And they are in traditional First Nations, Native American thought, it's not possible to own land. So the idea of white people coming along and saying that they've taken land, then this is now it's ours and all that, vast, all of it basically. And then after wars and negotiations, land being parceled out back to First Nations who never felt they owned it in the first place. And then this imaginary parcel of land, this shared hallucination, was whittled away until it's virtually non-existent. And in the case of the Umatilla people, now we're back to square one. Money is involved, white people are involved, and although this is supposed to be something of an achievement that was accomplished this week, there's so many questions and there's so much about this that should be talked about a great deal more. That's what we want to do today. Good morning, Chuck. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on board.
Talk a little bit. This has been big news, and of course, in Indian Country today, all of the republications, this has been a front-page story. Can you just refresh everyone's understanding of what took place this week in the white world of shared hallucinations involving money and land.
Sure. So most people know about the Cobell settlement, and Cobell was about individual tribal members and the mismanagement of the federal government of individual tribal members' lands and individual tribal members' money accounts. Then there was a second case called Salazar, and then a third case, Sisseton-Wahpeton. And the Sisseton-Wahpeton was a class action suit that encompassed about a dozen tribes that charged the federal government with neglect and malfeasance in their dealings with lands that were collective, meaning the lands owned by the tribal government and the tribal members collectively. For the Umatilla tribe, that would encompass over 250,000 acres of land, which was our original reservation post-1855, post-survey by the Grant Administration. And over the last 80 years, the federal government had mismanaged the leases that they signed with predominantly non-Indians, predominantly white folks, to farm, to do agricultural practices, to lease out and do timber harvests on our collective timber lands, and for other mineral and right-of-way issues. So this tribal government joined in that class action suit against the United States government to attempt to rectify lost revenues and lost resources over the last 80 years.
That said, then, you quoted in, I think, the Associated Press article talking about what your grandfather would have made of all of this. The idea of land of white people managing this land, or for that matter, any land at all, is if you really think about it, it's like, how is it possible for people to own land? This is a planet, we all live on it, and the idea that a member of one particular species has greater control over any given parcel of land, it seems to be a ridiculous idea. Not that this conversation would ever have any sway over the way the architecture of this these deals happens. No. Yeah, but like, look at the Donald Trump fiasco, making the transfer of land and the way it's managed, in the stark absurdity of it. It could not possibly be writ larger. So the Treaty of 1855 and the treaties were, until the rest of this came along, treaties were considered really quite unjust, but the best deal that people could get given under the circumstances. And now we have this. Where did treaties come into this new concept of this latest land management deal?
Sure. So there's a couple things. One, I was going to back up. I agree with you. The ideals of land tenure really are set in a Christian belief system, you know, under Genesis. And years ago when I worked in New York City, I was working with a rabbi, and we were working on developing new texts for the city of New York and talking about history. And one of the things that came up was land tenure. And he leaned over to me and said, you know, if the Bible had stayed true, because the Jewish people also share the original Old Testament, the word is so much different. In Genesis, as it was interpreted from Latin, it says dominance, that man will have dominance over all things on the earth, birds, the rivers, the waters, the land. And in the Jewish text, in Hebrew, it's actually stewardship.
Yeah.
And stewardship is a completely different ideal of land tenure, which much more mirrors North American native ideals of land tenure, that, you know, we only steward the land for the next generation to come. And so this idea of individual ownership is really the crux of the issue that we still face today with the federal government and with our surrounding communities. The Treaty of 1855, we granted the United States 6.4 million acres of land, and had believed originally that we had reserved for ourselves 500,000 acres. Of course, a grant survey by President Grant in 1877 reduced our reservation to 254,000 acres. That was further reduced. We were the first of two tribes in the United States to be allotted into individual Indian ownership. The Slater Act of 1885, it was the precursor to the 1887 Dawes Act. We were the experiment to find out what would happen. So our reservation is one of the most checkerboarded reservations in the United States, meaning that it has some tribal ownership and non-Indian ownership within the confines of the reservation. Though the treaty clearly states that the entire reservation is for the exclusive use of the Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla people. So we start off by the 1885, less than just 30 years after the treaty was signed, with the United States already breaking its agreement and allowing for what they call surplus land to be sold to non-Indians.
It seems also the question that comes up all at least to me it comes up is so there are leases on this land that allow white people to engage in mining, exploration for natural gas and so forth, and running cattle, farming and so forth. These leases granted for these activities on what's really land belonging to the Umatilla Nation. It seems that's almost sending a rather insulting message, because all leases could be, there's a lot of public land floating around out there, the Malheur occupation has brought that to the fore in a dramatic way. But it seems that given the amount of public land out there, leases for all of these activities could have been granted on other tracts of public land. Why does it have to be, why necessarily are First Nations people those who are going to be have land that so diminished in the first place, but further diminished by the granting of these leases, which could be granted somewhere else? Why do they have to be necessarily on the reservation?
No, I agree with you, Chris. It would. The United States owns so much land in common that you would think that individuals and companies would go after those parcels first. The issue is that the land protections that are afforded America's common lands versus tribal lands are much different. If the majority of landowners on a piece of parcel did not wish to lease to a non-Indian farmer or mining operation, the Bureau of Indian Affairs can override the wishes of the landowners. Where else does that happen in land tenure, but only on Indian reservations, in which the federal government can actually say, no, we find it's in your best interest. That is so antithetical to the U.S.'s ideals of land law, but it doesn't apply when you're talking with tribal members in tribal nations.
I think I would find it incredibly insulting. I mean, as a white person, I find it insulting. It seems going way beyond the bounds to even suggest such a thing, and then to go haul off and do it. It's that every bit of land on the reservation ought of course to belong to First Nations, always. There should be no question. So the Treaty of 1855 and its many and various violations over the years. Will First Nations people be negotiating with the federal government as a sovereign nation in the future to attempt to write another such treaty that would safeguard Indian rights and land use, land management might be by a new treaty be granted too?
I don't think we would sign a new treaty as much as we would just expect the old one to be upheld. So anything that's not specifically written in the treaty itself is a reserved right. we've reserved the right to manage our lands and our affairs the way we see fit. We just need to continue to remind the United States government of that. The Confederated Tribes and Umatilla Indian Reservation have one of the most advanced land development codes in Indian country, and it's used as a model throughout Indian country on how to manage those lands. And I think that helped play a major effect in the decision for the United States government to settle with us, because they knew that we can manage this without their direct involvement. You know, they still want to sign our leases, they still want to oversee that, but we have shown that as a sovereign people, as a tribal government, that we can manage our own affairs for what's best for us as a tribal government and what's best for us as our tribal membership who believe in upholding our land development codes.
Thank you so much for that, Chuck. I so appreciate you coming on the air today. This clarifies a lot for listeners, I think. Of course, this has been Chuck Sands has been our guest today, the Umatilla Nation, the Confederate Tribes of Umatilla, and this has been a Cascadia 4. Friday, September 30th, 2016. Don't forget, people, that 70 years ago, tomorrow, October 1st, that was the Nuremberg Trials, was one of the most preeminent trials of the last century, and it concluded when the International Military Tribunal issued the verdicts for the main war criminals of the Second World War. That's tomorrow, 70 years ago. Tomorrow, October 1st. And this has been a Cascadia for September 30th, 2016. Engineering for us today, Sam Parrish. Thanks, Sam. Kathleen Stevenson, as always, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.